Mark Maron is joining us right now. His new book is called A Tempting Normal. Mark Maron, he's got a new show on IFC called Maron. And, of course, his podcast has been on for many years and probably one of the most popular podcasts in the nation. And he's joining us right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Mark. How are you this morning?
Very well, Michael. How are you, sir?
I'm good. You worked last night, right? You must be pretty tired.
I guess I'm tired. I did a few sets at the Comedy Store, but you're right. I am tired. Should I go back to sleep, or you want to do this?
I don't know. Would you rather go in your garage and do this? You'd probably feel a little more comfortable.
I'm in my garage. I'm sitting here naked.
Great. You're consistent. I'll say that for you. That's amazing. So,
you're the only person that thinks that. I appreciate that.
No, you're consistently you. I mean, that's an amazing quality. But, you know, this
I thought you meant I was consistently consistent. Yeah, I am consistently me, and that's not always consistent.
No, inconsistently consistent. This new show, and your show is great, by the way. I love the IFC show. It's fantastic. But, you know, it has had the unintended consequence of making you endearing.
Yeah, I know. It's a painful thing for all of us.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to get through it.
Yeah. Did you expect that to happen? I mean, this last episode with Boomer, it brought out all sorts of feelings about you that I didn't know I had for you.
Are we on a date? It became tricky to, after the first season of Maron, when I had not really done any acting in a big way or writing in a big way or producing television, so I was very green and just trying to get the hang of things. And I think we made some choices this year about story and about the character of me on the show, what parts of me were we going to kind of sort of work with. But, Michael, I'm not a bad guy. You know that, right?
Yes, I know, and you keep trying to convince yourself of that, I guess, more than anyone.
Well, I just wanted to convince America that I was endearing while I still struggled with it alone.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of a new aspect. Does it at all change your affect in how you work? So once people start to find you so, they're charmed by you or they're sympathetic to you, it sort of puts a different edge on things.
Yeah, well, not unlike, my two ex-wives and many girlfriends. That'll wear thin after a while, and they'll see the real me. So.
Yeah. Well, and the great thing about the show is you get to make Sally Kellerman your mom. I think that's an amazing thing right there.
It is. It was a thrill to work with her, and I was so happy that she was able to do it. And she had a very good time being my mother. I think she shares a lot of the same emotional disposition, character traits as my mother. And my mother was actually happy that Sally played her. My mother now wants to meet Sally. She wants to spend time with Sally. And I'm going to try to arrange that, though I don't think it would be good for anybody.
Yeah. Did you run it past your mother before you cast her?
I'm not known for running things past people I throw under the bus. That's gotten me into some trouble. I told my mother. I think I told both of them who was playing them. And the casting was pretty true to both of them in a way. Though I think that Judd Hirsch, arguably was a better father than my father.
Ah, okay.
To me.
Your upbringing is very... he was a doctor, but he was a military man as well. Is that your dad?
He was a military man for 2 years, so yeah. I don't know if that... I don't know if we can say he was a career military man, but he was in the Air Force for a couple of years, and he took the family to Alaska, where he was stationed for a couple of years. So I have vague memories of the tundra, and then we moved to New Mexico. So, yeah, he was an orthopedic surgeon in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yeah. So in your formative years, you were in Alaska, or are you still in Albuquerque during whatever formative years are?
Most of the problems happened in Albuquerque, and that developed who I am now. I was in Albuquerque from third grade through high school, and then I went to Boston.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, was there an incident or a series of incidents or that sort of – you have a rather unique voice. I mean, you're full of self-doubt and maybe self-loathing, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't even know how well this is going.
No, this is not going. But – you're able to find, when you mentioned you were doing comedy one time early on, and you did a whole thing about the AIDS and the end of the world, and a guy came up afterwards and said, "Why comedy?" I mean, that's sort of a question, isn't it? I mean, it was comedy a way of getting out of some of these feelings, or why comedy?
That is a good question. question. That was a powerful moment that guy did that. It's a horrible question.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, and I still don't know how to answer it. I think that that to me, when I saw comics when I was a kid, that there seemed to be a truth there. These guys, comedians, were able to have a point of view. They were able to have a handle on the world. They were able to disarm things. They just seemed to really have a sense of who they were. And I think more than anything else, through most of my formative years as a comic, I was really trying to, kind of figure out who I was and be that guy. Mm-hmm. And it took about 25 years for that to happen, but that's really why I was in it. And it was just to have my own space, to have my own voice, to be seen, and to work through some stuff. That was always the agenda. It was never to be an entertainer, per se, but I thought comics were something more than entertainers, at least in my perception. And that's really what I think drove me when I look at my career.
Yeah. And working with Sam Kinison, was that a big part of it, or at least affected?
Yeah, that guy. Yeah, no, that was a big part of the. I don't know. I don't know that was a good time. I did a lot of cocaine. I was awake a lot, and I talked for hours about things that I have no recollection of, but they were very important at the time. That period with Sam was pretty brutal, and it kind of blew my mind. But I definitely learned some things about Sam, because when you do cocaine with a guy that's a star, you're going to hear a lot about that guy from that guy.
Right.
But yeah, it was a formative time in that I never wanted to go back there. I kind of lost my mind, and it's very interesting when you lose your mind, because you don't really know you're losing it at first, because you're pretty sure you're just enlightened. When you hear voices in your head. It's never one, it's always many, and you spend a lot of time trying to get them to pick a leader. So it took a while to shake that period of time, but I do think that it was an important time, because he was sort of an important comic. I think it's a little short shrift, because I think he was wrong-minded on a lot of things, but nobody really took it out as far as Sam. So it was sort of an amazing thing to try to chase that and push it out that far, and it took me about 20 years to reel it back in.
Yeah, in doing which, all comics sort of turn themselves inside out in front of audiences. But I think no one is probably as much as you.
I think that's probably true. But I don't really know how to do it another way. Sometimes when I'm on stage, I'll tell the audience. I'll say, look, I'm not always funny, but I think I'm always pretty compelling, and I know that. On a good night, that some people will leave the show saying, that guy was hilarious, and other people will leave saying, I hope he's okay, that guy.
Yeah.
He seems to be in trouble of some kind, and I hope he works it through. I kind of feel like waiting after to see if he needs a hug. He's in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
But it's not, that's not really true. It's an exaggeration. I do put myself out there, but it took a long time to really be okay with it and to not just push it on people and to, know where the funny is. I think I spent a lot of years just putting myself out there and being a little more shocking and a little more needy and a little more aggressive. So I think a lot of the laughter I used to get when I was a more angry man was just discomfort. And I think now I've got a handle on it. I know who I am. I've landed in myself. And I think I'm the best comic I've been ever right now.
Mm-hmm. What I like, actually, not so much the fundamental truths that might come out of it, but I like the little things. I like your when the thing when you're talking about hummingbirds.
Yeah.
They're actually very mean animals and ready to suck your ocular jelly, I think is what you said, out of your eyes.
They are horrible little things, but they're so cute. I think that maybe I identify with them. The sort of that line that they ride between adorable and horrifying is something I aspire to.
Yeah. And that just came about because you wanted something to do, and so you put out hummingbird feeders.
Yeah, now I still do it. I got that feeder out front, and I'm pretty diligent about it. Yeah, that was a story about my, one of them, had, I heard that thump on the window that can only mean, one thing, that, a dumb bird has thought it could come in the house. And and I go outside, and there's this hummingbird, and it's down. It looks injured. There's a problem. And, I don't know what you do in that situation. Is there a group that deals with this? Is there an emergency number for hummingbirds? Can someone come take care of it? So I didn't think that. But I didn't know what to do with an injured hummingbird. But at that time, my first thought was like, you know, I could just let my cat deal with it, you know, because, you know, that seems to be a natural way to do things. I don't know if it's the right thing to do as a human, but this stuff happens in the wild all the time. So I really fought with that for a while, because LaFonda, my cat, would have had a wonderful time with that dying bird. And yeah, ultimately, I think I made the right decision. I just, you know, as I was struggling with the decision, I went out and it flew off. So I guess it was just stunned and perhaps a little bit embarrassed. I was glad that it did what it did, because I just didn't know where I was going to go with it. I think it was just sort of sitting it out. It probably felt some other birds saw it, and that, you know, there's probably a lot of pressure in that community to be impressive and keep those wings going. So he was probably just waiting for them to go away so he could, you know, fly off quietly. And that worked out for everybody.
Yeah. And it's sort of the same thing with the cats themselves. I mean, you're not really a cat person. You don't put...
No, I'm a my cat person. I don't really care about your cat.
Yeah. Anybody else's cat. And you take
you
him... What?
I
don't have a cat.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying, one's cat.
You're just saying that? Yeah. I mean, I like my cats, and I have a couple... I had a couple cats outside. Well, you know that the last Marin this week was about Boomer. Boomer, he seems to be gone, but, you know, my hope is that he's living down the road a bit with a pleasant Mexican family that gives him, you know, wet food as opposed to the dry food that I was giving him. You know, that's my dream for Boomer. Or perhaps he's on a heroic journey with a dog that can talk and some other animals.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know. You know, and that, I have the two in the house that I captured.
That was
early.
A great episode. I loved everything about that. I love the fact about, you know, we were talking about the woman who lost her cat and about that cartoon where all the animals formed a group and found happiness together.
Yeah, the amazing journey, right?
The amazing journey, I love that part of it. And is that Shapiro? Is that Rick Shapiro?
Rick Shapiro.
Yeah, he was...
The amazing Rick Shapiro.
Oh, God. He was so good.
I've known him so long. You know, Rick is quite a character, and he's had quite a history in comedy. And you know, we go back about 20 or 25 years to the Lower East Side in New York, and he was... he's a force in nature, that guy, and he's come upon some hard times physically, and I think really that was, he was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's, I believe, and it took a long time for them to figure out what it was, and he was already a pretty shaky guy, you know, and, you know, he's always full of the juice and like a little bit, you know, amped up all the time, but he's really an inspired comedian and actor, and I think that was really the first role that, you know, he's done since they kind of leveled off on a medication that was working for him, and it was just a thrill to be able to give him the opportunity because he's such a vital presence, you know, on screen and on stage. And I was, I always had him in mind for the part, and I was just happy he was able to do it.
Yeah, that was absolutely amazing with the gun and shooting the crows and taking you to where you could see the entire Los Angeles from that hill.
He's really something else. I mean, you really got to... Yeah, look into Rick Shapiro. You know, he did. He was on the Louis C.K.'s first show on HBO, Lucky Louie, as I think the brother-in-law. And he did a lot of Louis's early movies too. He was around New York when we were all in New York, and he was just this. There's nobody like Rick. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I thought that was terrific. And once again, it was so endearing to see you going through all this anguish over your cat and so forth. And between your cat and your lost girlfriend, those two things. The girlfriend also ran off.
Michael, inside I'm a very sensitive, broken man. I mean, I don't. You're making it sound like it's a miracle that you can get people to like you at all.
No. I think it's not at all. I mean, it sort of dawns on you, and actually, when you see you going through your anguish, you know. That
I got angry this morning because apparently somebody in that room where you are right now was under the misconception that I was going to be there in person.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he decided to go ahead and throw a tweet up, and, you know, I'll read it to you. I paid $10 to see you, and you aren't even here, hack. So...
Yeah, this has happened before, you know.
To make this guy feel like he didn't waste his money, I'd like to say, Connor... Go screw yourself.
Connor, are you here, or did you not even... Where is Connor? Hey, man. Sorry, man. I'm sorry. He's not. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Connor.
Did that make the $10 worth it, Connor? Huh? Was that worth it?
Yes. C- Cool. Absolutely. Yeah, he's good with that.
I tell him he owes me $10.
We have that problem. We're kind of low budget. We're in Madison, you know, we get a lot of cross traffic of stars coming through here, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, you could have flown me out, Michael. I would have come.
Yeah. We couldn't, though. We don't have the money to do that. You have to fly yourself out here, and that's asking. You've been in Madison, I know, for your cancer scare. Was in a hotel in Madison,
Wisconsin. Oh, yeah, that happened there. Yeah, when I was,
mouth cancer thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a long weekend. It worked out okay. I'm okay. I'm talking. Everything's fine.
Yeah. It was really just a licorice that discolored some cancer.
Yeah, there's an episode coming up of Marin based on that, too, actually.
You don't throw anything away. That's what I love about you.
Well, I mean, what else am I going to do? You know, it's like either, you know, use my life or use my imagination, which seems exhausting.
Yeah. And going back to the book, you know, what I also, among other things I love, that cooking at Thanksgiving, the fact that you actually do this, right? You cook a meal, a Thanksgiving meal for your mother in Florida every Thanksgiving. Is that true?
I wouldn't say it's for her because she doesn't eat like a human. But
yeah,
it's for the people that she invites. Yeah, I have some family and some extended family and then, you know, hangers-on that come just because I do a pretty good job. So, you know, on any given Thanksgiving, it can be anywhere from like 18 to 25 people. And I go cook in my mother, who, you know, I like to say, I don't want to say that she's anorexic. I'd like to say that her job in life is to maintain a weight of 116 pounds. That's her lifelong job. And so I've got to cook in this kitchen that, you know, she's afraid to have butter in the refrigerator. I mean, a pint of ice cream will not last a night in her house because she'll go down in the middle of the night and eat three spoonfuls of it and then throw the rest down the garbage disposal. That's her dieting tip. Uh-huh. When in doubt, use the garbage disposal.
Yeah.
So going down there to cook for everybody is always a task. But but you know, we figured it out. She's gotten better over time. She'll allow you know, bread and ice cream and sour cream is very frightening to her. But you know, we've worked it out that she can allow that stuff in the fridge for a couple of days. But leftovers don't last long, especially if they have fat or sugar in them. She feeds the garbage disposal, and it's kind of heartbreaking. But yeah, that was a good moment in that story where, yeah, I don't know if I can capture it for the audience there, but there was one Thanksgiving where the stuffing that I make is, I'm pretty proud of it. It's a very impressive recipe. People come from miles around to eat it. And I was baking it in the, I don't cook it in the bird because that's for amateurs, because you're going to get a crappy turkey if you do the stuffing in the bird. Just know that, all right? You're going to overcook it. So I cook it outside the bird, and we were using the condo next door to hers in Florida where I was cooking the stuffing. And it had gone too long, and I burnt the top. And I lost my mind. I wanted to aggressively throw out the entire dinner. I wanted people to go home. And it was not a pleasant moment for anybody. So my mother, in that moment, says, just scrape off the top. And I'm like, you don't know what's happening here. My life is ruined. My reputation is hinging on this stuffing. And I don't know if I can go on. So I bring the stuffing in where all the people are, and the presentation, of course, it's sad because everyone's like, it'll be fine, and, you know, and I'm just devastated, you know, close to suicide, I think. And we took scraped off the black part, and everybody ate the stuffing and said, no, you can't even tell, which, what else are they going to say, Michael? You know, what else are they going to say? And then my mother just sat there alone, you know, she was standing by the sink, eating the burnt part. And she said, you know, Mark, the burnt top is really the best part. And this is a woman that doesn't eat. And I thought, well, you know, she's making an attempt. And at that moment, I loved my mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Another part of the book that I really liked, also speaking of little things, with the Levi's and the Red Wings. Levi's are very important to a young boy growing up, and you get very fond of them, and they're attached to you almost literally after a period of time. But it's impossible to recreate that, perhaps, as an adult, that feeling with your pants.
I don't know what's happened to pants. I don't know what they've done to them, Michael. In my recollection, I think I had a pair of Levi's that lasted me from fifth grade through high school. But maybe I'm wrong. But it seems like, you know, there's a couple of things that happen in the culture we live in, is that people don't feel that they need to break in their own pants. They will buy pants that, you know, either someone else has broken in or perhaps a machine. I don't know. And it's very hard as a grown man to find pants that fit properly. They don't seem to go up high enough anymore. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
But that story was like, yeah, Red Wings, isn't that also out there by you?
It's in Minnesota, isn't it? Red Wings, yeah.
Oh, it's in Minnesota, not Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I get this thing where, like, I get very loyal to shoes and pants. Like, I have this thing where I really need to make things my own, and I want to take the time to do that. So, you know, if I commit to a pair of pants, I'm going to wear them, you know, almost every day. And they don't, the thing that they don't have the kind of Levi's that we grew up with, but now they introduce this kind of Levi's that supposedly, you know, the kind that, you know, you can grow with and that you can break in on your own. And then I read this article that the way to do that is you got to put them on and then you got to sit in a bathtub with them and you never wash them. And then you get out of the bathtub so they form to your body, and then they're going to be the best pants you ever had. So cut to, I'm in a bathtub wearing pants. And then I get out of the bathtub after I sit in there and I walk around with wet pants for like 4 hours. Thinking that, well, this is gonna be the best pair of pants I ever had, and they weren't, Michael. They were not the best pants I ever had.
Yeah. And did you wash?
And them?
Did you wash them?
Well, after a while, you know, that whole idea of not washing your pants—it's like, you know, it doesn't seem sanitary, really.
No.
So
it's not,
you know,
it's not.
I went for a while, but it didn't seem to be making a difference. And then I was told, like, no, that's ridiculous. What kind of idiot doesn't wash your pants? I'm like, but the guy on the internet said, it's like, what guy? You know, you're right. I eventually got some better pants, some salvaged denim pants that I committed to. But if you wash them in cold and line dry them, you know, it'll be all right.
Yeah. And then the other thing about stealing from Whole Foods, justifying stealing from Whole Foods, I thought that was really an advance for mankind, almost.
Yeah, screw them. I mean, like, I don't even know why I feel that way. It's because, like, there's something insulting about the prices they charge, and there seems to be something righteous about it, the attitude of people that shop there, you know, me being one of them occasionally out of necessity if I need certain things, but I'm not proud of it. And I know that people like working there, and I think there's something evil about the place. The guy who's the CEO, he doesn't seem right-minded about healthcare and other things, and he seems sort of elitist. And I, you know, some part of me thinks that everybody should be able to afford good food, and I think that he thinks that, well, you know, if you can't afford good food, then maybe you don't deserve to live. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, I there was this moment when I was in New York and I'd gone to Trader Joe's, which also has problems, but you know, you do what you can. The vegetables there are not great, but I needed stevia, because that's what I use to sweeten things, because I am my mother's son, I am frightened of sugar sometimes. So I go to Trader Joe's to get the pure stevia, because I need the good stuff. And they don't have it. So then I go down the street to Whole Foods in Union Square in New York, and it's just crazy. So I go, I find the stevia I want, like $9, and I'm like, this should be much cheaper than this.
What is stevia? Do you know actually what it is?
I think it's from, it's a sweetener. It's a very sweet, very sweet sweetener that has no calories, and it comes from a root of some kind.
A root.
You know, I could look it up. Do you want me to look it up?
No, that's okay. Later.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a artificial sweetener that comes from something natural, so that they cancel each other out. It's better than NutraSweet or aspartame, which I think, you know, some people believe, you know, causes you to lose your mind. So, anyways, this is a lot more information than I planned to have. I would have done some research. Let's move on. So I'm at Whole Foods, and there's horrendous lines. And at the Whole Foods in New York, they actually have the lines with colors, that each line is assigned a color. So I'm looking at these lines, I'm like, these people are rodents, and they don't even know that they're not special because they shop at Whole Foods. Look what Whole Foods has done to them. It's corralled them into these colored coded lines and at that moment, I felt that I was completely justified to just leave with the stevia, because Whole Foods was a horrible, evil influence on everybody, and nobody knew it. And I think in retrospect, I just didn't want to wait online. So I take the CV and I'm like, well, look, you know, you don't want to get in trouble for this, so why don't you just walk out holding it up? Just walk out with it in your hand proudly, and if nobody stops you, then you deserve to have it. But it was almost like it was almost my hand was in the air like a fist of rage. So I was able to justify that as a revolutionary moment. Like, I'm leaving with this stevia because you're wrong, all of you. And I walked out just holding it up. And also the thought was that if someone goes, did you pay for that? I could go like, oh, I didn't. And they just think I'm crazy, and I go back and pay for it, like, because I'd just be holding it up. So I walked out, and I held it up as I walked out, and then I stood out in front of Whole Foods in New York City in Union Square holding up stevia, almost baiting anybody to stop me from taking it. And then no one did, and I'm like, well, you know, snooze, you lose. And I walked off with it, and I justified it as a political act.
I love it. While not encouraging others to do the same, because then it would be a movement of some sort.
Yeah, I don't want that responsibility, but, you know, it's fun. Yeah. There's a thrill to shoplifting. It's a crime for a reason.
Steal the stevia has a ring to it. And, you know, also another, it's a small thing really, but this idea for Googleheimers, I think, is really a great idea.
No.
It's an amazing way of tapping this resource that remains untapped of older people's take on things, the recollections of things.
Yeah, that idea was an impulsive, improvised idea initially where, you know, I'd spent some time in Florida and there are these huge, retirement communities of elderly people that, that I don't know if they have a lot to do, but they seem to be amazing resources of information, of historical information. So my idea was that, you know, you create a search engine that was really the engine itself was just these retirement communities. And like you do a search on something, and then like a light would go on in some elderly man's apartment, and you would go to his computer, and you'd be maybe researching the Kennedy assassination, and so a light would go on in like, you know, some old man's apartment, and he'd go to his computer, and he'd be like, oh yeah, the Kennedy assassination. And so the information that you would get on the search would be like, that was a bad day. We were very sad. We had cheesecake earlier, which didn't sit well with my wife. And then you use that in your research paper. It was, you know, it's a weird idea.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. Because I feel like I'm entering that point now, because I find myself talking to college kids. It's a college town. About the 60s and stuff and all the things we went through, you know, in those years. And so I feel almost like I could be one of those Googleheimer resources. You know, I like to go off and...
Yeah, I mean, you are, I'm sure. You know,
yeah,
it's
pretty much.
Yeah, it's strange as things, you know, it's hard for me to tell as we get older whether or not, you know, the stuff that we all live through is actually, you know, losing its relevance to younger people or that we are irrelevant. It's very difficult to sort of see the difference between aging and sort of what is an astute cultural criticism. Do people not care about context anymore? I mean, my biggest fear is that we'll get to a point where a high school student will say, like, oh yeah, I know who Hitler is. He's the guy with that mustache.
Right.
You know, so that's a scary possibility that there's no context, but, you know, fleeting images on the computer that have no impact at all.
Right. Well, you get to the
I'm
point.
I'm sorry
where,
to make it dark and sad, but
no. It's you get the point where actually no one gets any of your references anymore because they're not their references, you know. So you have to stop and sort of footnote things as you're saying them.
Yeah, yeah. You can't say, "Do you dig it, kids?" I'm sorry, Michael.
Attempting normal. It sort of is what you do, isn't it? Do you really aspire towards normalcy? Because it would ruin your act, for one thing.
Well, you know, it's like people always ask me, it's like, what is normal, man? There's no normal. What are you judging yourself against? And the answer to that is everyone else. So, I don't know if I'm attempting normal, but I think, like I said earlier, it was just, you know, there has to be a point where, you know, I can have a little bit of peace of mind. You know what I mean? But But I do feel a little better than I used to. I'm not as angry as I used to be. I don't think it's normalcy, but I would like to, you know, function on a day-to-day basis without a tremendous amount of dread and panic. I don't think that's asking for too much.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had a window there for a little while where it seemed to go away. Because I think as a comedian and as a creative person, you know, what I was striving for, I don't think, was ever to make a living, but it was to be relevant somehow, to have some impact and to share something. You want to hope that your creativity will lead to that. And I think that once the podcast sort of took off, that, you know, that I felt that whatever part of myself I was looking for on stage sort of filled itself in, and I was sitting with some genuine self-esteem for the first time, and it was uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable.
What I love about your interviews and stuff, and you get all these great people, you've talked to everyone that you want to talk to, but they always end up being about you.
I was in trouble at the beginning, and I needed help, and I needed important people to help me. Yeah, I think that the origin of the show is definitely that I didn't know what I wanted to do with the show, but I wanted to talk to other people about me. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having major celebrities and stars into your garage to help you. Right. It's awkward for them.
No, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, as someone who does interviews and stuff myself, you always think, well, my idea is not about me. It's about the person trying to bring them out. But yours is sort of the opposite of that, and I think it's terrific, actually.
Well, thank God it evolved, because that got a little weird for everybody. But, you know, now, but I think the part of it that worked, you know, because I don't really see myself as an interviewer. I see myself as a guy who talks to people, because, you know, I'm not that meticulous with preparation. And really what I'm seeking in any one of these talks is to really connect with this person on an emotional level. You know, even if I don't know them, I have an idea of who they are. And that's really my agenda in my heart is, like, you know, I just need to, you know, connect with this guy or this woman. And, you know, at the beginning, it was a little more needy. And now it's evolved into something else. I have found what I think I had as a younger person, this, you know, the ability to be moved and compelled by someone else's story. At some point during the journey of WTF, I became an empathetic listener, which I think I'd lost some of that because of my cynicism and my own problems. But it seems to have returned in almost like a childlike way. And to talk to people with interesting lives and compelling stories, as you know, is very rewarding, because there's not, you know, if I'm sitting in my room and, you know, like the other, who did I have on the other day? You know, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top is sitting in my garage. And, you know, it's mind-blowing to me. And he's just telling me stories about opening for Jimi Hendrix. And like it's crazy that, my garage is not a nice place, really. And, I mean, it's nice, cozy. It's not really a car garage. It's like all my books. My entire life is in my garage. Yeah. All the artifacts from my life is in here. So when people come in here, they are literally sitting in my head. To have these people in here and to have them sort of, you know, disarmed by that and not really realize they're on the mics and actually have these human interactions is so thrilling for me, it still is, and I've done 500 of these things, and I just love it.
That's great, but I do like it when you tell someone to get out of your garage. I think that's quite a thing to say.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes it's time to go. I don't think I've said that angrily to anybody, but
no,
I had, you know, there have been moments where people have lingered and it's uncomfortable. You know, Conan lingered a bit, and I've done Conan's show for a long time. You know, he's had me on as a comic since the beginning of the show, and then when he came over to the garage for the first time, it was really the first conversation we ever had. But we've had this weird 15-year relationship, you know, on camera, on and off, and I never talked to the guy. And there was just that moment, because that was sort of early on, where we finished the conversation. It was great. And then we're in my house, and, you know, and Conan's just sort of hanging out. And in my mind, like, you know, I'm like, and he's a large guy. He's like 6'6", and, you know, and in my mind, it's sort of like, well, I know that, you know, it's not like we're going to hang out now just because we had this conversation. I'm not going to go to dinner at his house. Or, you know, this is really the end of the line for this thing. And And, you know, he's just sort of standing around. And in my mind, I'm like, you know, how do I get Conan out of my house? I mean, it's just awkward because, like, there's no way to really end this. I mean, I don't even know how to say goodbye. Like, all right, I'll see you, I guess, on the show if you put me on it, you know. So it was awkward. But, you know, we were both awkward in that moment. And he left, and it worked out okay. He's doing fine. It didn't seem to bother him.
Yeah. First to come and last to leave, Conan. Mark, I want to thank you for taking the time to do this. I know you're a busy guy and you're working all the time. Mark Maron, it's called Attempting Normal. Thanks so much.
Great talking to you. Take care.
It's great talking to you.